have a couple of important announcements to make to you, and I'll do them after the sermon. But I want to get into the text this morning found in Mark chapter 12, verse 18 through 27. If you can, there we go. And some of the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him, and they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies and leaves his wife behind and leaves no children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and dying he left no offspring. And the second took her, and he died, and nor did he leave any offspring. And the third likewise. So the seven had her and left no offspring. Last of all, the woman died also. And therefore, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife shall she be? For all seven had her as wife. And then Jesus answered and said to them, Are you not therefore mistaken, because you do not know the Scriptures nor the power of God? For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. But concerning the dead that they rise, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the burning bush path, God spoke to him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. And you are therefore greatly mistaken." I like the way Jesus said that. When you think about heaven, I wonder if you have a lot of questions like others do. For instance, how old will you be in heaven? If you live to be 50, but your son lives to be 80, will you be 50 in heaven, and will your son be 80, or will we all be 25 years old? Will you be taller? Will you have more hair? Will you be better looking? Will you be smarter? What will things be like in heaven? If you have a child that dies when it's 3, will it be 3 for eternity in heaven? What's it going to be like in heaven? Well, the Sadducees had a stirring question, and that had to do with marriage in heaven. I wonder if you've ever thought about that. They come to Jesus, and they say, Jesus, and it's a trick question, by the way. They say, Jesus, a man or a woman had seven husbands. Whose husband will be hers in heaven? Now, again, this is a trick question because the Pharisees did not believe in heaven. I think they were probably more agnostic about it than atheist about it, in the sense that they probably did not know whether or not there was a heaven, as opposed to outright saying that maybe there was no heaven, although I'm sure both points of view were among the Sadducee cult. The reason that they did not believe or did not know whether there was a heaven was that the Sadducees only accepted the law of Moses. They only believed in Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Leviticus. They only believed in those five books of the Bible as complete, without a doubt, inspired. Now, they put Moses on a pedestal. The reason they did that was because the other writers, they had questions about their inspiration. For instance, David wrote a lot of the Bible, but David had some down seasons in his life. Who's to say that some of the Bible wasn't written by David in a backslidden place? Solomon wrote some of the Bible, but again, who knows when Solomon fell off the Holy Ghost wagon? We don't know. And Daniel and Isaiah and Samuel wrote the Bible, but they did not receive their word in the way that Moses would have, because Moses received his word when he went to the mountain, and God gave it to him personally. And so that makes the writings of Moses more inspired, according to the Sadducees. And according to the Sadducees, Moses never spoke definitively about heaven. Moses had spoken definitively, that would have been something. They knew that Daniel had. They knew that Isaiah had. They knew that David had spoken about heaven. But they said, Moses never spoke about heaven. He never spoke about a resurrection. So how can we be sure if there is a heaven and a resurrection? And so they present to him this gotcha kind of question. There's a man, and this comes out of Deuteronomy chapter 25. A man has a wife. He dies. There's not a son to bear his name. Moses' law said that if that should happen, that if there was no son to carry on that man's name, that she would be given to the next oldest brother, and that he could have children with her, and if they should have a son, that son should have the name of the brother who died. So that son would be recognized as an heir of the brother who passed away. Now, they say in this situation, there were seven brothers. She married one. They all died. Clearly, she's a serial killer, but they don't mention that. They all die, and then finally, she dies, and whose husband will be hers in heaven? Now, they offer that illustration as evidence that there cannot be a heaven. Because, after all, human problems are so complicated, even God could not work them out in heaven. The evidence, again, that there isn't a heaven to the Sadducees is that our problems are so messy here on earth that even in heaven, God can't fix those problems. You got seven husbands. Who do you figure who she belongs to? See, that's a huge problem. Who can know the answer to that problem? Even God can't know the answer to that problem. So that's evidence that there can't be a heaven. But Jesus looks at them and he says at least three things. He says, first of all, you don't know your Bibles. You don't know your Bibles. Because if you even knew Moses, you would know that in Exodus chapter 3, verse 6, that when God came to Moses, he said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He didn't say, I was. He said, I am, meaning that they're still alive. I'm presently, they've died, they've gone on earth, but I'm still their God. Jesus says, that means they're still alive. So even Moses says, there's a resurrection in the heaven. He says, second of all, you're stupid. Didn't say it that way. He said a little nicer. But he said, listen, when you go to heaven, you're like the angels. And angels don't reproduce. There aren't babies born in heaven. You're not up there reproducing and creating new people in heaven that were never on earth. I think that's the point. So you don't need marriage in heaven because you don't have reproduction in heaven. So you're just dumb. You haven't thought about that. But then third, I think this is important because I think after Jesus says that, he anticipates their obvious question, which is this: if there's no marriage in heaven, how can it be heaven? We're back to the original issue. They say you can't have heaven because the problems on earth are too great to ever be sorted out in heaven. Jesus says, well, you don't have marriage in heaven. And then they have to come back and say, essentially in their minds, but see, that's the point. If there's no marriage in heaven, how can you even call that heaven? Now, to that issue, I think Jesus says, you don't know the scriptures, you don't understand the angels, but third, verse 25, package there, he says, and you don't know the power of God either. That's the point. See, what they're saying is that if we can't work it out, then God's not capable. If we can't envision it, then it can't happen. Now, people have recreated heaven based on earthly dreams. And so the Indians loved to hunt, so where did they go? Happy hunting grounds. And the Vikings loved to get drunk and fight, so where did they go? Valhalla, where you fight and drink. The Jews were not really a sea-going people. They hated the sea. They saw the sea as a place of chaos. So for the Jew, there was no sea in heaven. Heaven is always created as a place that fulfills our greatest desires. And for the Sadducees, then, what's the greatest desire? Where they're much like us. It's for romance and, well, you know, sex. And so if there can't be those things in heaven, then how could you possibly be happy in heaven? I mean, if we can't have that, then how can God make heaven heaven? That's a huge problem. And again, Jesus says, listen, you don't know the power of God if you're even asking that question. You don't understand what God's capable of doing. I mean, listen, when I was a little boy, I loved baseball, and as a 10-year-old, I would feel so sorry for the people in the stands. What kind of miserable life must they have up there, not being able to play baseball? I didn't understand there were things a lot better than baseball in life. Wasn't that sensitive yet? C.S. Lewis says it most famously. He says, to explain to us what heaven is like is to try to explain to an 8-year-old chubby boy that there's stuff better than chocolate and watermelon and ice cream. There's a lot of stuff better in life when you get to be an adult, but he can't comprehend it. And what Jesus then is saying is, listen, you don't understand the power of God. I mean, even marriage on earth, I mean, that's like the telegraph compared to the iPhone. Marriage on earth, I mean, that's like a stencil compared to an HDTV. Marriage on earth, that's like a horse and buggy compared to a jet. You can't comprehend that there's anything better than you've got, so you can't understand how a powerful God can give you anything better. You don't understand the power of God. See, we have these issues even when we ourselves think about heaven. We can't comprehend the power of God. I have mentioned this multiple times here before, but one of the things that we think about when we think of heaven is, what's God going to do with our memories? I mean, if you go to heaven, you're going to have loved ones that went to hell. You go to heaven, there's still trauma, there's still abuse, there's still difficult things that have happened to you that have been traumatic and that have caused great problems for you later on in life as you remember them. What's God going to do with all the memories? And we say, how can it be heaven if I have all of these memories? How can it be heaven if there are loved ones that aren't maybe with me? But when we ask that question, again, we don't understand the power of God. We don't comprehend what God might be capable of doing. Somebody said, well, can he go in and edit out our memories? He can do that. And possibly he will. But the Bible also hints to the fact that he can take our memories and give them a dream-like structure. Psalm 73 says that when the ungodly wake up, that it will be as a dream. Their prosperity will be as a dream. And you know what that's like. And we've talked about that before. A dream feels so real. A nightmare can feel so deep. But when you wake up, it's like, oh, it was just a nightmare. It really wasn't even real. God can do that with us. And in a strange way, if he did that with us, even the pain of this life makes heaven all the more wonderful. I've told you about waking up once. Jenny and I had not been married long, and I dreamed that she had been killed one night. And, I mean, it was so real. And I woke up, and there she was. And I, you know, got a bad case of the kissing bandits all day. It's like she didn't understand what got over me. It's like, it's like reliving a second honeymoon. I mean, I love her. This is great. This is wonderful. She's alive. And that was one of the great days in life, because the sense of having lost her, but knowing it was only a dream, made having her all that much better. You know, 1 Corinthians says, death will be swallowed up in victory. And when you swallow something, it makes the thing that did the swallowing that much bigger. And even the hard things in life make the victory that much greater. I mean, it's amazing how a woman can go through childbirth and it be so grueling and so painful. But when she holds her baby, it just all disappears. It's all gone. The pain of that is gone. We don't know what God is capable of doing. That's what I'm trying to tell you. You don't know the power of God. Jesus says, we look at our problems and we think they're so big. How is God going to work out? And Jesus says, you don't understand what he's capable of doing. Now listen to me, God, and this is what I'm driving at. It's a very simple point. What I'm driving at is that God is going to do great things then. Jesus is saying, you can't comprehend what he's going to do. And we read the Bible, we knew what he did back then. But I'm going to tell you something. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. God can do some big things now that you can't comprehend. Now, we're in an age today in America where the issue of sexual identity is at the forefront. And I realize that's a complicated thing if you feel like you were born in the wrong body. I get that if you experience same-sex attraction, I get that that could be quite difficult for you. And I realize that that is a complicated thing. I have a great friend who's a Christian counselor, and he says when he counsels people who have had same-sex attraction, almost always their very earliest memories, that even their dreams and fantasies were same-sex. Even when they were 3 or 4 years old, they can remember having those kinds of feelings. So I realize it's very complicated. I realize it's a big problem. But if you say, I don't think I could ever be changed, or I don't think God would ever give me the power to handle this feeling, or that God could not even take this away, understand you're saying, I don't know that God's that big. You're almost saying what the Sadducees are saying, which is, how could I ever be happy in heaven if I didn't have marriage and sex? God's saying, you don't, and Jesus says, you don't understand what God can do. You don't understand his power. But you're saying, how could I ever be happy on earth without following and fulfilling these desires? And again, you don't understand the power of God if you're saying that. Don't understand. And you're elevating your problem over what God can do in your life. You're saying, well, this is a problem that's too big for even God to handle, so I'm just going to live with it and pursue it. And you're taking this identity issue and you're elevating it to the point where you look at people who have maybe a 20-year pornography addiction where it's even changed to shape. Brain, and you're saying my problem is bigger than theirs, and my problem is bigger than people with bipolar and severe depression, and my problem, it's bigger than men who have had or women who have had sexual addiction in their life. My problem is bigger than people who have had significant drug addiction. God can help all those people, but my problem's too big for God, and I'm telling you, it's not. Can't say that your stuff's bigger than what God can do in you, so I'll just have to live with it. And since it's so big, I'll just pursue this because God can't do anything about it. God can. He's able. And your imagination is too small if you think he's not. I mean, you look at your heart sometimes. Sometimes our heart can get so hard. And we say, how can God change my heart? After all that they've done to me, I don't think I could ever forgive them. But that's not too big for God. Ezekiel 36:26 says to those people that I can take your hard heart, and I will take your hard heart, And I will take that heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. God is able to do that. You may be in a place where you can't even feel. It's so hard. The trauma is so deep. It's gone so far. It was years. It was pain. There was betrayal. There was depression. There was complete destruction in your life because of what they did. You're a stone in that situation. But you can't say, my pain, my heart, my struggles are too great for God. If you say that, you don't understand the power of God. Can't say that. You can't look at that loved one and say, too far away from God. They're too far. Too much has happened. It's gone. You can't say that. People said that about the Apostle Paul. He was a murderer. He was the worst excuse for a person you could be. He was a self-righteous, religious, violent man. But he wasn't too far for God to turn around and to make a pillar in the church. He wasn't that far gone yet. I was talking to my sister, and we were going to do something, but she couldn't come. She said, I got to go to a baptism. And I'd known that she'd been praying for this woman, but I didn't know that she had come to Christ because she told me about this woman. It was a neighbor that moved in about 20 years ago. And her neighbor was like the queen of Wokesville. She had inherited, she was an heir of one of the many heirs of the guy who founded the Lear Jet Company, and had inherited a lot of money when she was 18 and had lived life to the fullest. And by her own profession, there was absolutely nothing wrong with anybody doing anything. I mean, she celebrated every lifestyle to the fullest. But she lived that way. But then she had a child. And when the child got ready to go to school, all of a sudden she didn't want her kid to get into the stuff that she celebrated when she was 18. So she decided to send her child to the only Christian school nearby, which was a fundamentalist Baptist school. Having a child enrolled in that school was you had to go to a monthly parents' Bible study. And she always left infuriated at what she heard. And then she had to volunteer some. And my sister said, you know, if you volunteer some, you can't swear. And she said, I don't think that's possible. I should volunteer. Because that's just part of her. She hated what the church taught. But again, it was the only place where she felt her kid was safe from the culture that she had espoused when she was in her teens and 20s. Well, something happened in a Bible study. And she gave her life to Christ after resisting Christ. And my sister had prayed for her for 20 years. For 19 years, saw no fruit from those prayers. And last Sunday, she got baptized in a fundamentalist Baptist church. It wasn't Episcopalian or Methodist. It was fundamentalist Baptist. Folks who were viral. I mean, they were solidly against everything she had stood for her whole life. She joined the opposing team. Listen to me. You can't just say that person's beyond God. You can't say your problem's bigger than God. You can't say your heart condition's. You can't say anything is bigger than God. If you do, your imagination is not great enough yet. I mean, let's take even some personal things we struggle with. You can't say that anything that happens in life is bigger than the purposes of God in your life. I mean, you look at death sometimes. And when somebody dies, you say, well, what can God do with the death of my loved one? How can anything good come from this? Your imagination isn't great. That's what they said when Jesus died. That's what they said when Stephen was stoned. But the death of Stephen, I believe, was the main thing that prompted Paul to carry the gospel to the ends of the world, because Paul had killed Stephen. And I think that when Paul started to see the potential of Stephen, he said, the life that that guy had lived, I've got to go live. I snuffed out a great evangelist, which means I've got to be a great evangelist. I think even the death of Stephen was what prompted the writing of 14 gospels or 14 letters in the New Testament. You can't look at anything that's bad that happens and said, God does not have the power to transform that desert. God does not have the power to bring beauty from those ashes. God's big enough to do it. I mean, you look at your family, say, my family's a mess. How can God bring anything out of this? Well, listen, Joseph's family was a real mess for a long time. Joseph had brothers who tried to kill him and sold him into slavery. But you know what? God had a plan in all of it. It was part of God's plan. It was a way to get Joseph down to Egypt and a way to save the family, the families you. But Joseph had to be shot like a rocket down to Egypt. Even the division, even the attempted murder, even the selling into slavery did not frustrate the plans of God. Did not. I mean, you look at your life and say, how can any of this, or how can God be working? God works in strange ways. Preached through the book of Esther last week, and I'm still in Esther, but I mean, when God was working, you know how God started to work? The king got gassed. It's the first step. The king was boozing, and then he went to Jack Daniels. But that's the first step. That was the first step in the plan of God to save the people. And then he sent to get his queen, Vashti, and said, I want her to come parade herself. She's so good looking, they're calling for her. So somebody goes and says, Vashti, get out of the jogging pants and the leotard, put on your pretty dress. The king wants you. And she says, go tell Mr. Big Stuff, who does he think he is? I'm not coming. And then he banishes her. And then Esther wins this beauty contest. And through all of this mundane, crazy, carnal stuff, God's plan was coming to fruition. God is big enough to use a drunk king and a queen who goes Hillary Clinton and another beauty queen and save a people. He can do stuff like that. Can't say that he's not able to do that. God is big enough. And he's bigger than your problem. And one of the great problems the world has is a lack of imagination about what he is able to do. Now listen, if you want God at work in your life, let me say this very quickly. You say, I believe that he's able to do maybe more than I'm thinking he can do. And I got feelings I don't know what to do with. I got a heart that is just broken. I got a heart that's cement here. There are people in my life that, and something's got to give. I want God to do something. What should I do? And the first thing that I would say is you got to make sure you want God to do something. It's not a dumb question when Jesus says in John 5:6 to the man who's been paralyzed, do you really want to be well? Do you want to be well? Do you really want things to be different in your life? See, we tend to believe that action follows belief, but that only happens in rare occasions. Usually, belief follows action. We make up our mind what we want to do, and then we make up our mind what we're going to believe. And that tends to be true. Aldous Huxley was an atheist. And wrote Brave New World, was a great philosopher, if you consider, you know, atheism, if you can be a philosopher, be atheist. But he said, don't let anybody tell you they became an atheist because they thought their way to it. He said, I became an atheist because I wanted sexual liberation. I came from a conservative household, and I didn't want to live with the guilt. There were things I wanted to do, and it was more convenient for me to become an atheist. I later believed it, but I started it being an atheist as a way of sexual liberation. Timothy Keller is a great counselor, great pastor, and he says that he had a lot of people going off to college who were raised in his youth group, and they would come back after a year saying, I don't know if I believe what I was taught in the church. I'm beginning to think that maybe all of that isn't true. And he was about that to go to a friend who was an older, wiser pastor, ask him, what do I do with all these people going to college, coming back, and their faith is really wobbly? And the older pastor said, well, there's something that I do that always works, but you got to be really courageous to do it. He said, if you'll do this, you'll get to the root of the problem. It always works when a kid says they're a little dicey in the faith. He said, ask them who they're sleeping with. He said, because inevitably their faith gets shaky because they go off, they fall in love, they want to sleep with people and not feel guilty, so they start to change what they believe to fit how they want to act. And he said, that's the way it is. People don't believe and then act, they act and then shape their beliefs. So the question is, do you really want to be well? Do you really want to be well? You say, well, I don't know if I believe. Yeah, but do you really want to be well? Do you really want to be delivered? Because you can have certain attractions, you can be in a relationship, you can have a certain addiction, and you want to be well at times when it's a real hindrance to you. You want to be well when there's, you know, bitter fruit. But generally, you go back and forth between wanting to be well or not. Do you really want to be delivered? That's the question. Secondly, are you willing to act courageously to be delivered? I saw something. I should have just preached on Esther this morning. It's what I should have done. I saw something in Esther. I hadn't seen that last week. Mordecai is sending some news to Esther. And he's saying, it might be chapter 4, but let me see if it's chapter 3. he says to Esther, in fact, I think it's chapter 4. Let me tell you what he says. He says, if you remain silent, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? That's a famous quote. Now listen to what Esther says and tell me if it seems strange after reading it a couple times. This is what Esther says. Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast from me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My mate and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Do you notice anything different or strange about that verse? It's what I hadn't noticed. Esther says, I'm going to do something before she prays. She said, I'm going to the king in 3 days. I'm going to do something, and I might get killed. But even before I pray, I've made up my mind, I'm going to do something. I'm going to act. I'm going to do something courageous. Now, I'm going to pray that God will help me. I'm going to pray that God will lead me. I'm going to pray that God will go before me. But I'm not going to even pray before I've decided to act that I'm going to do something courageous in my life. That's a powerful thing. And really, it's the essence of faith. Because anytime you see somebody displaying faith in the Bible, they're acting courageously. Noah builds an ark by faith. Abraham leaves his country and goes to a place he knows not where, by faith. Moses chooses not to be a son of Pharaoh, by faith. Rahab hides the spies by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith. They acted courageously. And if you and I are then called to pray in faith, without faith it's impossible to please God. If faith is key in praying, then you've got to decide to be courageous before you pray, or you're not going to pray in faith. You have to decide something's got to give. I got an addiction. It's going to end today. I don't know how it's going to end. I'm going to act radically. I don't know if that's quitting my job. I don't know if it's leaving this relationship. I don't know what it is. But I have decided I've taken my last drink. I don't know how that's going to happen. I'm going to pray about it. I'm going to fast because God's going to have to open some doors. God's going to have to help me. God's going to have to give me some wisdom, but God's not going to have to give me the willpower. I'm showing up at the prayer meeting with the willpower to make that decision. If you're in a relationship, you have to say something's got to give. We've been fighting for 20 years. We go to church 3 times a week and fight 7 days a week. Something's got to give. We have finished being the Cramdens. Something's got to give. Our marriage is going to be different. I don't know how we're going to do it because we don't even know how to stop fighting. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we are going to do it with God's help. We're going to do it. I mean, listen, if you're trying to quit something, if you're trying to forgive somebody, you got to say, listen, I've carried this burden long enough. I've carried this guilt long enough. I don't know how I'm going to get rid of it, but I know today is it. Enough is enough is enough is enough. It's gonna be done. God, will you help me do it? Listen, sometimes you're not praying with power, and you haven't felt power in your praying because you don't pray with faith. You don't pray with a sense of courage. You don't pray with a sense of resolve that something's going to be done. In 3 days, I'm going to the king. I might die, but I'm going to do something, and God help me not to get killed. That's what Esther was saying. You got to make up your mind that something's going to happen. You got to want God to do something, and you got to be resolved. Something's going to happen even before you pray. And then you need to receive what God is saying to you. There's a chance he could say, wait. But I want to tell you, a lot of people think God's saying, wait. God's saying, just be still. Hold on. Well, he can do that. But if you're praying little resolve, and you're praying without a sense of courage and resolve, you're probably not hearing anything from God. You're interpreting his silence as wait. You're not even praying in faith. It's amazing what you'll hear from God when you say enough is enough is enough is enough. This is going to change one way or another. God's going to have to help me, but I've made up my mind. Today's the last day I smoke. Today's the last day I drink. Today's the last day I pop a pill. Today's the last day I log into that website. Today is the last day we have that drag-out fight like that. Today is the last day that kid runs over me. Today is the last day. I don't even know how it's going to change, but I'm telling you, it's going to change, and I'm going to pray and fast, and I'm going to ask God to do something, but I'm telling you, today's the day. It ends today. It's amazing how much power you'll have when you pray like that. It's amazing how you'll hear from God maybe for the first time in your life. When you hear from God, you do what he's asking you to do. You do what he's asking you to do. God can sometimes just zap you and take the desire away. And if you're going to have a change of heart, he's going to have to zap you. God will often zap you and you'll feel a power to deal with that issue that you never had before. Sometimes God will say, listen, for a while, I'm going to give you daily strength. So if you're serious about stopping drinking, go to your 90 meetings in 90 days. And every day, I'll give you the strength. Every day you get up and say, today is it. I didn't drink yesterday. Today, I'm not going to drink. If you'll resolve in your heart and that's what you want, I'll give you strength today. And maybe the day will come when you don't even desire that at all. It means nothing to you. He might give you strength along the way. But I'm going to tell you something. If you're resolved, God at work in your life, you can count on Him. And I'm saying that in faith. You say that's a bold thing. No, no. If you want it, and you'll pray in faith, you will be amazed how God can work above, beyond what you could think to ask. That's in the book. That's in the book. Will you stand with me?